You can't have your cake and eat it, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it's interesting, the Luminox watches I utilize, I have one right now that's 22 years old, and it's still lit up, but I'm just starting to see it dimming a little bit. And they guarantee them for 15 years, which makes sense, but the one I have is 22 years old, and it's just starting to dim, and I've been thinking about, shopping for a new one, but makes sense with the 12-year half-life.
Yeah, I mean, for all intents and purposes, it has approximately one quarter of the radioactive material that it had when you bought it. It's enough to light up some of the material. It's not as bright as it is, and, over 22 years, you tend to forget exactly the luminosity of your lit hands. Ed wanted to say something. What did you want to say, Ed?
The waste water we're talking about is probably like 1 billionth or less of the concentration we're talking about here.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like I said, it's very, very dilute, and you couldn't sell it unless you spent way too much money in somehow concentrating the tritium supply of it. So it's not worth the trouble. It's kind of the same thing you mentioned, that seawater has some tritium, but you'd have to be a lunatic to get your tritium from the sea. They do that for deuterium, but in deuterium's case, it's one atom out of every 5,000. So it's a lot more cost-effective to spin down the hydrogen in seawater to heavy water and deuterium and such.
H2SDP.
Yes, Chris.
So the seawater comment leads me to the question, and that is, there are hundreds of different kinds of jellyfish, probably thousands, that are luminescent at different times. We run them over on the boat, and they light up behind us. I'm wondering if any, I've always wondered, are any of those radioactive in any, obviously there'd be tiny, minute amounts of radiation, but are they radiation or is it some other kind of lumination that's going on there?
AC2GS. Yeah, it's chemoluminescence. It uses the ATP power source that runs our muscles and such that generates photons.
That's non-radiation, I guess.
Yeah, it's all purely chemical reactions. You're taking high-energy molecular bonds and breaking them into lower energy and using the extra energy to produce and emit a photon of light. So it's all chemoluminescence. It's chemical light. No radiation required.
Interesting. Pretty amazing, because they're some of them are super bright. It's amazing. Interesting. All right. KQSDP. Thank you.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it's amazing what biology will come up with, that they've been able to produce light sources, they can produce electrical potentials. I still remember visiting the Coney Island Aquarium where they had this big electric eel, and one of the big shows was a voltmeter connected to some prongs, and they annoyed a electric eel and showed you how many thousands of volts it was emitting from its muscle structure. So it's sort of amazing that what biology is capable of. Fireflies. Everyone has seen fireflies, I hope. They're particularly nice on some summery night to see them blinking away. Sometimes they synchronize with each other. That's fun. Any other comments or questions or answers or what have you? I think this is an interesting subject, Ed. I appreciate that you brought it up. I try my best to be enthusiastic about science. I try to be somewhat skeptical so that people don't kind of race ahead of a press release. There's a happy medium in this world. So, I just wish that the general public had a much better foundation of science. So I think that they would understand this a little bit better, and the word radiation wouldn't drive them insane.
WB2EAB, all the comments.
Certainly, Ed.
A few years ago, we had a presentation on the subject of nuclear power plants that was heavily based on a trip I had to Indian Point. And in my presentation, I went into the usual Chernobyl, Fukushima Daiichi, Three Mile Island, and I did mention Shoreham, but as a financial disaster, not a technological one. But then I had a section, I entitled it, The Monster Under the Bed Demands Equal Time. And then I went into all of the catastrophes that have happened related to fossil fuel power.
Yeah, unfortunately, those things kind of get lost in the mist. It's what excites people, interests people that they obsess about. And they obsess about things like radiation. We've talked in the past when electrification of factories was a novel new thing. There was a time that there was no such thing as generally available electricity. Workers demanded hazard pay because, if you were going to actually be using high voltage technology in a dangerous way, I could see. But just any secretaries working in a factory wanted hazard pay because those damn electricity is going to kill everyone. So, some things people make into bigger problems than they warrant, and others they feel more comfortable about, and so they don't give a damn. So it's very weird, us human beings.
Wait a minute, Roy. Maybe they were right. They're all dead now.
Yes. What can I tell you? Maybe causation and correlation are the same things.
On the other hand, I guess the ones who weren't electrified are all dead, too.
Well, no theory is perfect, right? Anyway, you have nothing to be sorry about, Ed. Anyway, if anyone has any further comments on this particular subject, we have a few minutes. Oh, well, I guess people are burnt out. I mean, there's a lot of things in the news that are scaring everyone. Microplastics. Are you familiar with the fear of microplastics? That, unfortunately, biology doesn't know how to get rid of a lot of plastics, and they're building up all over the place. And in actuality, a very similar thing happened. There was a time that biology couldn't quite deal with trees. So trees would die and they would fall and they would just kind of sit there forever and turn into coal or oil or something else. But there weren't yet biological organisms optimized for digesting the cellulose and the other materials of trees. And then Mother Nature took a turn and it learned how to eat up all the old trees, and now we don't have a problem with that. So if we wait long enough, biology will figure out a way to mutate some organisms and make it capable of digesting our microplastics, if we can wait long enough. Okay, I assume that there are no fans or enemies of microplastics among us. It's a very anger-inducing subject on the internet these days. You know, just throw the term microplastics out, and you'll hear a lot of people yelling and screaming out there. Okay, two people doubled simultaneously. I think one of them was Chris.
Yes, it was. I just wanted to add everyone used to be scared to death of oil getting spilled. Of course, it's not the greatest thing in the world and kills lots of animals and makes a mess. However, they have since found all that oil that dumped into the Gulf was engulfed by some organisms that eat oil, and they flourished, and then animals ate that, and it actually did a whole bunch of good down there, believe it or not. So it's probably the same thing will happen with plastic someday.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a matter of you have to wait long enough, and, before it happens, it's another thing for people to worry about. There were two people who doubled. One was Chris, the other was another person, which I didn't recognize. So the other person, please hit that push to talk.
AD2ZU, I was going to ask if you use plastic water bottles or avoid them, or is there any other, like, regarding the plastic thing, is there anything in your life you avoid?
I do not think so. I'm not a big bottled water guy, so probably it doesn't make that much of a difference. I won't turn down a plastic bottle of water if it's cold and I'm hot and thirsty. You can only live so long, and I guess if you lock yourself away in a lead cube, you might extend a very boring life by, 0.0001% or something, but you're just going to spend it in that lead box. So I generally, as I go down the laundry list of my head of favorite things that everyone's frightened of, gluten and corn sugars, although, too much sweets isn't a good thing generally. I'm not one of those guys who, I can't eat that, I can't eat this, that is going to give me that, this is going to give me this. So generally speaking, no, I don't have any problems dealing with water in a plastic bottle.
Wi-Fi is the thing people are scared of in apartment buildings, weirdly, a lot. We see my neighbors attacking me with Wi-Fi.
Well, again, that's because of the term radiation. Since people say that the RF is radiation, it frightens them in the same way that nuclear radioactive material does for no apparent reason. And if you sit them down and you try to explain to them that at the frequency of radio waves, all that's produced is waste heat, and going out into the sun produces a lot more waste heat contaminant. So if you're afraid of Wi-Fi, you probably should hide in your basement with the lights off. Irrationality is part of humanity, unfortunately. You try to explain to people as best you can, and you deal with the hysteria.
You made a pretty good case the other week to be scared of sunspot explosion stuff from 1840. 82 to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, the universe is not our friend, unfortunately. And so, we could be sitting here nice and quiet, and a gamma burst from a neighboring solar system's exploding sun that just happens to be pointed straight at the Earth could just kind of fry us all in a femtosecond. So nature, you should respect nature, because nature could really mess with us. So yeah, you could have outbursts from the sun that can fry could be just like a massive electromagnetic pulse weapon and fry all of our electronics and drive us back into the 1800s.
WB3AB.
Yes, Ed.
There are a lot of other things. I mean, meteorites, at any time, a meteorite could streak in outer space and kill one of us. There's things like that. So there's a lot of stuff out there in the universe that kill us. By the way, a lot of people live near extinct volcanoes that can become non-extinct. Which reminds me of a little story I have about Mount St. Helens and Pompeii.
Okay.
In 1993, when the kids were about, I don't know, 8-10 years old, we went on a trip out to the Pacific Northwest. And my mantra was, I want them to see rivers and mountains. And that included Mount St. Helens, which was 13 years after it blew, and they'd already built the visitor center there. And there was an observation deck where it was obvious which one of the mountains, like 13 miles away, was Mount St. Helens. I saw this V-shaped cut. The top of the mountain was missing in this V-shaped cut that just gave me this feeling of evil. Anyway, in 2016, the wife and I, no kids this time, they're, you know, grown up on their own now, went to Italy and we went to Pompeii, where I got a look at Vesuvius, and my jaw dropped. It looked exactly the same.
Yeah, that's what volcanoes will do to you. The way I look on nature, it's not good, it's not evil. It's indifferent. It doesn't care. It just does what it does. And if you get in the way, tough.
Yeah, but that really shocked me. So see, pyroclastic flows are more common than we realize.
Well, fortunately, we haven't had to deal with one of those personally. But yeah, I've seen pictures of Vesuvius and Pompeii, and there are unfortunately people kind of frozen in time there, amidst all of that dust and debris. Nature, like I said, nature trumps all. We think we're powerful. We think we can destroy the world. Nature can destroy the world much better, much easier, much more thoroughly than even we can, although I'm sure we're going to try harder as time goes on. Any closing comments before we call this segment a day? Very well. Thank you all for participating tonight. Please come back next Sunday when we'll do it once again. Now it is time for the SpaceNet Report with Paul WS2M.
Thanks, Roy. AC2GS WS2N for the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet. And, I always make up at least a couple of items, make a list up, things I want to cover. But today I had to cross one out and make it a little different because one of the topics was Russia was about to land on the moon with a spacecraft. But this afternoon, sure enough, it showed up on the news, actually on the news on TV as well, that the Luna 25 lander is not going to make it. It crashed into the moon. They had sent signals to send it into, it was already in orbit around the moon, elliptical orbit. They wanted to bring that elliptical orbit lower to a point where eventually they would be able to land near the South Pole, but it didn't work out. I don't have any exact details on what went wrong, but, probably a software problem it looks like maybe even a navigation problem. They were supposed to have navigation equipment from the European Space Agency, but, ESA got out of that deal when Russia invaded Ukraine. So maybe it had something to do with that. Anyway, they're not going to be the first country or this private company is trying to do the same thing, to land near the South Pole on the moon. We're definitely going to be trying it, and the company that might get the award for doing that, it's not China, but it's India. Today's the 20th, so that means the 23rd, Wednesday, their vehicle, the Chandrayaan number 3, hopefully they make it to the South Pole successfully. They launched in July, I think middle of July, and it's taken all this time to get into the proper orbit for them to do that. Russia launched just last week. They launched from Voskochny, Russia, which is like 3,000 miles east of Moscow. It's actually closer to Alaska. They built this new spaceport out there, and they've been launching there for quite a few years now, but I guess about 5 or 6 years. So they launched the Soyuz rocket with this Luna 25 on board. Thing weighed a couple of thousand pounds. It wasn't light. It was tall, about 10 feet. It was going to be solar panel. It had a lot of batteries and stuff. And they thought it might be able to last a year on Mars. On Mars, on the moon. But that's not to be. This was the first try since 1976 when they launched Luna 26. That was successful. 26 landed on the moon and got some samples and actually returned it to Earth. So that was a successful mission. But that's back when it was the Soviet Union. This is their first shot at the moon since they've been just Russia. And it didn't go so well. But hopefully India makes it. India tried it in 2019. With a similar vehicle, Chandrayaan number 2, and that was a combination mission. They had an orbit, which is still orbiting the moon, and then they had the lander. The lander, came in. They thought it was going to make it. It came very close, and I believe that was a software problem too. Vehicle wound up flipping over 180 degrees, and I believe if they had more fuel, they think it would have corrected itself. This time they have more fuel, and they compensated for that, and they also have a better landing system. But they think they might be able to do it. We'll see how they make out in a few days. Any questions? WS2N.
Paul?
Yes, go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, I particularly found the report, the turn of phrase, to be intriguing. Here's a little snippet that I read. It says, attempts to reestablish communications failed, and Luna 25 had deviated from its planned orbit and, quote, ceased its existence as a result of collision with the lunar surface, end quote, Roscosmos said, which is a weird, interesting turn of phrase.
Okay. Yeah, if that was SpaceX, they would have said, well, it had a RUD incident, R-U-D, rapid unscheduled disassembly. But, yeah, I think it had to do with the lack of navigation equipment on board that they were supposed to get from the European Space Agency.
Oh, well, better luck next time.
Well, I read about a month or so ago, they said this is going to be their last shot. You know, if this works, they have a plan for Luna 26 and Luna 27. They were going to be launched in 2 and 3 year intervals, you know, 2 or 3 years from now, and so on. But they said if this thing fails, it's going to be the end of Russia's involvement with the lunar program for now. The funding is not there. I wonder what they're spending that money on.
Funny.
Okay, very good. Well, they don't have any. Their rubles are down to, I think, now one ruble to it's a 1 to 100 ratio. You know, $1 to $1. So I think they said 100 rubles equal a dollar. So they're in bad shape economically. So I was actually surprised that they launched this mission at all, you know. But I guess they needed some kind of a flag waving event to compensate for what they're doing, and that's not going to happen. Okay, there is a launch that's coming up. I'd like to probably watch on YouTube. It'll be from Japan. From the Takashima Launch Complex. It's going to be another space telescope. It's called CRISM, but it's spelled with an X, X-R-I-S-M. And Japan has built this thing with the help of NASA, so it's a JAXA and NASA mission. And it's called the X-ray Imaging and Spectroscopy Mission, and they pronounce it CRISM. But we'll see how this thing does. It's going to look for X-rays, and hopefully it works good. It's going to launch on the H-2 rocket, which is liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket. That's their heavy lift vehicle. In Japan, they have the H-2A and the H-2B. The H-2A launches all their science missions like this. You know, if they were going to launch directly to the moon or something, it would be on the H-2A. The H-2B, they pretty much retired. Really the same thing as H-2A. It was just set up differently, and that launched cargo vehicles. Like to the International Space Station for years. They used to launch one like once every year, the HTV cargo vehicle, which was a heavy lift vehicle. I mean, they got like 13,000 pounds up each time to the space station. But they've retired that HTV cargo vehicle, and now they're building a new one, but it's just not ready yet. And they're having trouble getting the the H-3, which is supposed to replace the H-2B, and they're having some technical problems getting that rocket to fly. It should have been flying already. We'll see. Japan's doing okay. They're signed up with the United States for the Artemis program. They plan on helping us construct and build some modules for the Gateway space station to eventually be put into lunar orbit. So hopefully CRISM gets off the ground okay in a couple of days. Let me drop it. And we'll go over to the story about the Stereo A and Stereo B mission. This information came actually as an email from the ARRL, although I read about the two missions, you know, a week or two ago. They were saying that you got to know what the Stereo A and Stereo B missions are. Back 17 years ago, they were both launched into heliocentric orbit. So one was going to go around the sun in one direction. The other one was going to be still going in the same direction. But the difference is one was going faster than the Earth's orbit, so that over time, Stereo A would get further ahead. They called it A for ahead, and then Stereo B would drift behind. They launch it in the other direction, where it would slowly drift behind the Earth's orbit. So, the two of these things would eventually become 180 degrees apart in relation to the sun. And as time goes on, as the years go on, they would eventually come back to our Earth, and that's what happened to Stereo A. Stereo B quit working a while back, maybe 5 or 6 years after it was launched, it quit working. But A kept going, and sure enough, it's still operating, so NASA's still getting information from it. What these two vehicles do, they take pictures of the sun, they look for corona mass ejections, they look for sunspots, x-rays, anything that's coming off of the sun, and they're able to determine with much more accuracy of, let's say, which way the solar wind is going at a particular time and how fast it's going, by having two spacecraft, Stereo A and Stereo B. They were able to see really like 3D imaging coming off the sun. Where, if you just take a picture from Earth and you just get that one view, you don't necessarily get as much science as you would do with A and B. I'm just surprised they haven't launched a follow-up to these missions. They were very good for the scientists. But anyway, Stereo A was still functioning good, and the reason the ARRL sent information out about it is because there was this ham, Scott Tilley, call letter VE7TIL, came out of Canada, and he heard that it was possible to copy the signals coming from it. See, now it's gone. Well, Earth, 93 million miles away from the sun, so this thing had gone all the way around the sun, and sure enough, it's coming back. So it's like it's only like a million miles or so away from Earth, relatively close. So the signals were easy enough to pick up by this ham. I think he used a 2-foot dish to do it, and the signals were booming. He said, like, 30 over. He also figured out how to decode it, decode the information that was coming off of it, and with that he's copying scientific data from Stereo A. So I thought that was pretty interesting, and I thought I'd bring it up. Apparently he's doing it, and I guess if you have that capability or that software, anybody could do it. You'd have to do it during the daytime, because stereo wave. It's in a closer orbit to the sun than we are. So, you know, the Earth would have to be facing the sun to copy any information. So, that's pretty good by this one fella come out of Canada. Any comments? Okay. Another mission that will launch very soon, actually this November. It's called the Nova C Lunar Lander. A company called Intuitive Machines is building it. So they're giving the Nova C the title IM-1. So eventually there'll be an IM-2. IM, you know, standing for Intuitive Machines. There'll be a 2 and 3. They're under construction, but 1 will be ready to fly this November. It's a Falcon 9 to get it off the Earth. And hopefully that will be able to land on the moon. Original plans were to land, you know, roughly equator, that kind of area of the moon. But NASA's very interested in the South Pole. And they've made their changes. They, the people at Intuitive Machines, to land overseas near the South Pole, a crater called Malapert A, which is one of the craters that they believe is near the bottom is solid ice. But it should be good. I mean, if this one lands successfully, I could. Picture in the future having other landers do the same thing, and by the time Artemis 2 is ready, which will eventually fly, Artemis 2 will fly around the moon and back, but Artemis 3 will actually land, that's the plan, to actually land on the South Pole. I can imagine one of these vehicles taking 4K pictures. I mean, they have high-quality cameras on board these vehicles, images of a manned mission actually coming down and landing on the moon. That would really be something. But this thing's, capable of doing everything. It's a hexagonal cylinder. It's got 6 landing legs on it, which is good. Solar panels, which could put out over 200 watts of power, and it should be good. Have the capability of having rovers on board, small rovers, and all of that. They only have a planned 14-day existence on the moon. You know, one day on the moon is 14 days, and then it goes up to nighttime. But down by the South Pole, maybe it'll last a little longer than that. You know, the solar panels will eventually start to dim out, but eventually go black. I guess, we'll have to see. Sometimes they plan these things to last the whole 2 weeks, but depending on the systems they have, the heaters on board, how long the batteries could last, how many amp-hour batteries they have. Who knows? Maybe they could get through the night and maybe get another 14 days out of it. But if not, to do what I said before, to actually have pictures of one of these landers coming down, eventually you'll have to have vehicles on the moon that have the capability of doing that, being able to go through the night, a lunar night anyway. And not to be outdone, there's another company, Astrobiotic. Peregrine lunar lander that was tested on Long Island, by the way. It was they had brought it to a place out here near me in Bohemia. They tested Peregrine out. make sure, you know, everything's okay. And they plan on putting that on the first Vulcan launch, first Vulcan rocket, which has not flown yet, hopefully early next year. I mean, the plan was to try to get it off the ground at least by the end of this year. That kept getting put back further and further. And that's the one with Blue Origin's engines that United Launch Alliance signed up for. ULA is a combination of Lockheed and Boeing. They signed up with Blue Origin to build their engines, which have not flown into space or flown anywhere yet. They've just tested them, you know, hundreds of times. But hopefully, Vulcan gets off the ground soon, and its very first mission, they plan on taking Peregrine, built by Astrobiotic, on a lunar trip to the moon. And, of course, if that's successful, like I said, they have plans just like Intuitive Machines. Astrobiotic has other plans for bigger and better landers. They plan on being capable of bringing materials, food, and everything to lunar, you know, to astronauts that could be staying there for extended periods of time in the future. Any comments? There's another one called Trailblazer, and that's also being built. They plan on launching that also on a Falcon rocket, maybe in the first couple of months, maybe February or March of next year. And that'll be another one that will be we'll be following on this net for sure. We'll see. A lot of vehicles getting ready to do. We've had, I think three of them in the last 5 years that have not made it. One by India, another one recently by a private company, Impulse, and then the other one was just today, Russia. So it looks like, I'm going to bet that India is going to make it with this. We'll see. I hope somebody makes it real soon. Any comments? Okay. The Artemis 2 people got to see their Orion spacecraft. The Artemis 2 crew went to Cape Kennedy, and that's where it's located now, and the only thing left they have to do there is put the Orion spacecraft on top of the service module, which is built by the European Space Agency. Not like the Apollo days. The Apollo days, we had the Apollo and the service module were both built for the United States. Here it's the cooperative between the European Space Agency and NASA. NASA took care of the Orion vehicle, and the European Space Agency is taking care of the service module, and it's already flown. Both of them have actually flown to the moon and back, a 25-day mission, and everything was successful. The thrusters worked good. Separations worked good when it came time to land the Orion vehicle. You know, the service module is going to supply, you know, most of the power that the Orion vehicle is going to need. It's also going to supply the water that's going to be needed for human habitation, oxygen, the nitrogen tanks. We should have an oxygen-nitrogen mix. So everything to do with human ability to stay alive the service propulsion is going to be all part of that. Any comments? Okay. The Cygnus vehicle, International Space Station at this time, that's one of the ones that got launched from Wallops Island recently. That's just what they did, and launched that on the Antares rocket to the International Space Station. They only need food and supplies, scientific equipment, and it's brought up by all these cargo vehicles. You have the Cygnus that's attached to it now. You have the Progress vehicles still being sent up by Russia, and then you have the Dragon cargo vehicle always being sent up by SpaceX, and you have Cygnus. Well, recently they tested this out on the last Cygnus vehicle. They want to make sure that that NASA could push the International Space Station into a higher orbit. As the months and years go by, the space station orbit decays. It's supposed to stay around 250 miles above the Earth. Over time, it starts to decay, and you know, if nothing was done, eventually that would be the end of the space station. So periodically, they reboost it to a higher orbit. Space Shuttle used to do it all the time when it was attached. It would push it to a much higher orbit. Sometimes they'd rise 14 miles higher or so, I remember, with a shuttle. They've done it with the European Space Agency when it had the ATV, the automatic transfer vehicle, which was another heavy lift cargo vehicle that European Space Agency used to send to the space station. They used to have that attached to the back of the whole space station. And any fuel that was left in that, which was a lot, they were able to push the space station again to a higher orbit. And they've just relied on the trips of the Progress vehicle to do that work. Sometimes they'll do it with an actual crew Soyuz vehicle. If they know they have a lot of fuel on board, they'll give the space station a little push. But sometimes they need to push it a little for one way or another to sometimes coordinate with a mission that's coming up, that where it's going to have something docked to it soon, so they might even use it for that. But they need that capability. They do have jets on the, you know, not jets, they are thrusters on board the space station at the back, which sometimes they'll use that as well. But most of the time they use the vehicles. And last time they tested it with Cygnus, make sure that the United States could do it, because you know, Russians are really not that dependable anymore. And you know, that was successful. So this time they made a point of it. You know, they probably had a lot more fuel on Cygnus. You know, they gave it a good push this time. And they do that before Cygnus departs. You know, all these vehicles except for Dragon take all this junk and garbage and things that are no good on the International Space Station anymore. They load them into the cargo vehicles up over the South Pacific. The only one that doesn't really do that is the Dragon crew vehicle. That'll come back, as well as the Progress vehicle. Not Progress, the Soyuz vehicle, when that comes back. Not to be outdone, eventually NASA will have the Starliner being built by Boeing docking with the space station. They'll have a crew going up and down on that. And someday in the far future, although I don't think they're going to make it, they'll have the Dream Chaser cargo, the cargo version that's coming first, but eventually a crew version. But I think they're going to be too late to be able to use the cargo version, the crew version, correction. for the space station. Any comments? WS2N for the Space Net Report. Okay, there's a mobile launch vehicle at NASA that's being built, you know, from scratch. Right now NASA uses one of them, mobile launch vehicle, to launch the space launch system with the Orion spacecraft on top. And that's what they used last time for the first flight around the moon. These are like billion-dollar structures, these mobile launches. They're built to support a rocket. And in this case, this thing is like almost 400 feet tall, like standing on the top of a 40-story building if you're up there. Now, the one that they have now is what they've used for a space launch system. What they do is they have that inside the vehicle assembly building, located on top of a platform. They bring in parts of the Artemis mission, which would be the core stage and the solid booster stages, and eventually the stage followed by the Orion spacecraft, and on top of that they would have the space launch abort system on top of Orion. All this has to be assembled inside the vehicle assembly building, but it's always being done with the help of this this mobile launch system, which NASA has successfully used for Artemis, and they're going to use it for Artemis 2 as well, for Artemis 3. The difference is, on Artemis 4, unless things change, they might find themselves doing this for Artemis 3 too in the future, because there's some logistic problems going on. But anyway, the next when they switch over to the heavier lift vehicles, and that's what they're going to need, because not only are they going to be launching crews, they're going to be launching space station parts to go to the moon to become part of the Gateway space station. They're going to need this second stage. Right now they have a second stage with this one 25,000 thrust engine that Artemis 1 used and Artemis 2 will use, and it looks like Artemis 3. But then after that they switch over to the exploration second stage, which is going to have four of these rockets, located instead of one. Instead of one 25,000 pound thrust thing, you're going to have four, so you're going to be coming out with almost 100,000 pounds of thrust on the second stage. But it's a bigger diameter, it's longer. That means the connections to supply liquid oxygen and liquid fuel to this thing, liquid hydrogen, has to be relocated. It's going to be at a much higher height. So the overall space launch system will actually be a lot taller than what you see today. But to do that, you need a different launch mobile system. This mobile launch system is being built by Bechtel. Bechtel is one of the biggest contractors in the world, and they got the contract for this thing. And they're already now presently building, bringing in prefabricated parts and assembling the early parts of this mobile launcher, which is like a billion-dollar project. Originally, NASA said, well, we'll wait. We'll 1, 2, and 3, and then we'll just rebuild the mobile launcher that we have to accommodate the new one. And I always thought that was a bad idea. Time went by, either somebody got the bright idea that, well, we should just, you know, start building another one. These things take forever to build, and it's always good to have two. You know, if you want to still launch the old version of Artemis 1, you can, but if you want to, you know, Artemis 4 and all the way up, you'll have the new launch, mobile launcher. And you also won't have the lag time. You know, if you get to 3 and then it's time to rebuild this thing, it might take you 2-3 years to chop the other one apart and and create a new one. So apparently they decided to pour the extra money into this and eventually have that. You know, the whole setup eventually rides on a crawler. You know, right now, you know, when it's all put together, you have the mobile launcher inside the vehicle assembly building, and you have the space launch system also in there, and it's all mounted on a crawler, this big crawler. The crawler pulls into the launch of the vehicle, and it rises up, and it lifts up the whole setup, and then it drives four point five miles from building out of the launch complex 39B. The whole setup is left there. The crawler drops, you know, the crawler stays the same height, but they have these lifting posts that lift the whole setup up, and the launch crawler pulls out, and it just leaves everything there until launch day. So, you know, they're moving along, which is pretty good. I really don't have anything else, Roy, so maybe we'll turn it back to you. 11 o'clock, almost. AC2GS WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Back to you, Roy.
AC2GS. Thank you, Paul. Our rebels now are done. Thank you, Paul, for the SpaceNet report, all you do here on the technical net and all you do on the club business. We all appreciate it, and I especially appreciate it, so thank you. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight. You guys make or break a net. Hopefully you feel that you've made this one. I think so. And please join me next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. As always, I like to close with a couple of quotes. Dick, K2RIW, who did this for many, many, many years, would end most of his technical nets with the request to be kind to each other. It's always good advice. And I always like to bring up good old Epictetus, an ancient Roman philosopher, who used to say it is impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So try and keep an open mind and try and learn something new every so often if you can. I just want to say thanks again for joining me and participating. I hope you have a great week. I hope you enjoy this week of summer. Don't get too sunburned. Don't get too hot. Don't get too wet. Be well. Stay safe. And this is AC2GS formally closing this episode of the Limark Technical Net. And my closing line, as usual, is Slava Ukraine. I am clear.
Yeah, have a good night, Roy. No, I was thinking about, I don't know if you ever had one as a kid. I had this transformer. It was a neon transformer. I wish I had it today. And hook it up to, I made a Jacob's ladder out of it. Did you ever try one of those things? What a blast.
Yeah, I think my parents would have a heart attack if I played with that high voltage. I was fortunate in that they either didn't know the dangers or didn't care. I was the kid in charge of the television set. I would regularly poke my head inside there and, you know, fix tubes and such. But unfortunately, I never had something as nice as a high-voltage transformer. I got to disassemble some Bell Lab telephones and figure out what made them tick, some transistor radios. I even pulled the cap.